Luke chapter 20, beginning in verse 27 is our passage. And as we come to this little section here, this is kind of the, as you read there at the last verse, you kind of find this section where they say, for they dared not to ask him any more questions, right? So you kind of are getting this kind of wrap up, some sense of finality to this gauntlet that Jesus has been running. And if you recall, over the last several passages, going back into chapter 19 and even before that, but, you know, we've kind of been honing in really in the text just to chapter 19, the Pharisees and the other people who are the religious leaders at this time, they have really put a focus on trying to trap Jesus in his words, trying to get him to say something that he would really regret, or catch him in saying something that they could use against him, either with their own people, or trying to use it against him with the Roman government, who are kind of in charge of Israel at this point. They are occupying this particular lands. And you see, in the previous section of chapter 20, they come out and they challenge his authority. The Pharisees ask him, "Hey, you know, in what authority do you these things, or do you speak?" They're coming at him and trying to challenge him, and he navigates that particular trap. And then he begins to tell this parable in the next section to kind of highlight authority a little bit more. And then he has this other exchange with them in the next section about paying taxes to Caesar. And they're like trying to trap him there to be like, "Oh, are you somebody who's really for Israel? Or are you against Israel? Are you for Rome? Like, which team are you on?" And, you know, Jesus kind of ends there with that statement that we talked about last week, where he says, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and the things to God that are God's." And in that statement, what we said there was, when he says that, he's not just simply saying like, you know, like you should just go about this in a very rote way where you're just going through the motions. In fact, he says that to highlight there by holding up a coin that Caesar's image is on his coin. It's stamped in his image. And so because it's made in his image, it belongs to him. And by saying render to Caesar's the things that are Caesar's, he's saying, well, if Caesar made this, it belongs to him. And then he says render to God's the things that are God's. He's reminding us that we are a people who are made in his image, made in the image of God. And so it's not kind of just like this random, like going through the motions loophole, but he's really saying that you need to have accountability for your life because you actually belong to God. And so if you belong to God, you ought to render to God the things that are God's. You should do the things that he's asking you to do. You should follow him. If he's the creator, then you follow the form that the creator has given to you. Right? And that is when life works out best. When you do, when you operate according to the framework and the boundaries that he has put in place for you to flourish. And when you go outside of those boundaries, that's when there are things that tend to bring hardship and difficulties in life. When you go outside those boundaries that God has set, that's when you find yourself in trouble. It's an analogy that I go back to often, honoring the form in which something that's made, the function with which it was made, and not trying to do something that is outside of the parameters for which it was made. If you've ever worked with making stuff yourself or trying to repair something at home and you don't have the proper tools, right? You kind of grab something nearby, right? You ever try to use a butter knife as a screwdriver, right? And it's just like, this is not working. It's just like painfully difficult to kind of get that going, right? And then maybe you have a really nice opportunity to have a proper tool there to use that screwdriver, right? And then you can tighten it up just in the right way. And then beyond that, you go to the next level where there's like a very specific tool set to meet a very specific need, specialized tools for specialized situations. And in each of those, the form that it's made for functions best. It's a pleasure to use like specific tools in specific situations. But if you go out and you try to use that butter knife to do it, a lot of times you end up ruining the knife and you end up messing up the screw or the surface. So there's a lot of collateral damage that happens as a result because it's not designed to operate in that way. Or oftentimes, I'll find at my office there's a lot of boxes that we get. We open a lot of packages, and I'm always reminding the people that I work with that, like, don't be, flipping open the scissors and trying to, like, go across them. And lo and behold, what happens time and time again? They end up getting cut or there's blood everywhere, right? It's because you're using a tool that's not designed for that particular thing. And when you use the proper tool, it puts the exercise of going through, of opening those boxes or honoring the form with which the tool was designed to function, that allows just such a pleasurable experience. It puts it where there's speed, safety, success, all of those things happen correctly. But when you go outside of that, you end up tearing up your hands or tearing up the box or cutting the thing that's on the inside of the box. There's all sorts of stuff that happens as a result. And so one of the ways that we operate as God's people and where he's asked us to do is to follow that function with which we've been created. If we are made in his image, we belong to him, then we will function best when we are honoring that call on his life. When we do what he has asked us to do, when we live in a way that honors him, and we walk with him daily, then that doesn't mean that we are going to have the easiest life ever, but it does mean that we are going to function properly within the parameters with which he has laid out for us. And it does mean that we will have everything that we will need to make it through those circumstances and those situations. There's not an opportunity for all of this hurt and harm that come from these external sources. Because God always wants to lead us into a situation where we are walking with him faithfully. And so this is the situation that Jesus is trying to do here with the people who were hearing, the Pharisees there. He's trying to tell them that you guys have been living in this way where you are serving Rome. You're kind of going on your own way and doing your own thing, but you are made in the image of God. He's calling them to change their lives, to reorient their lives in such a way that they would be honoring that particular form and function for which they've been made. And so this is what he's communicated to them, and they're not able to deal with him. They've been opposing him. They're not able to deal with him. And so they marvel at his answer, but they don't have a comeback. And so the Pharisees, really, they fail in their approach at tripping him up from a political standpoint. And then now we come to our text this morning in verse 27, where we find that a new group, the Sadducees, this is a new group that is entering, they take their opportunity, they try their hand at tripping Jesus up on a theological issue. So Jesus has begun to kind of navigate. He's navigated a political issue. He's navigated, now he'll navigate a theological issue here with the Sadducees. And so here's what we read in verse 27. There came to him some Sadducees who deny that there is a resurrection. Now, this is important info for us because otherwise this passage doesn't make any sense. The Sadducees were a sect of the religious leaders who respected only the Torah. That's the kind of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. So the rest of the other biblical books that are in the Old Testament, the prophets and things like that, they were like, no, we're not about that. They are strict adherents of these first five books. And so they were super rational, very wealthy. They're probably the most conservative group. They reject oral tradition. So it's like, if it's not in those first five, we're out. They held firm to this, and they really just kind of wanted to preserve the status quo. They didn't want to change anything. They're just like, we're good as it is. We don't want to move anything. We're fine here. We only care about the first five books. Really operating in this particular way. And so as they were the most kind of religiously conservative group here, this ends up at a certain point becoming a back and forth with the Pharisees. So there's kind of a power struggle at point. There's the Pharisees, the Sadducees that are kind of battling over whose particular theological teachings are going to have final rule, final sway. And after Jerusalem falls in AD 70, we see that it's the Pharisees who end up winning out, and the Sadducees do not end up being successful in propagating their beliefs as much. But as Luke tells us here, that the Sadducees do not believe in a resurrection. They also deny the existence of angels. They deny that, like, there's like these supernatural spirits that would be demonic. That they don't believe in any of that. And so this is the basis for which they are coming to Jesus, and they ask him this question. We see beginning in verse 28. Now, we'll read the story. We'll kind of get the idea here. But the way that they kind of show up here, and the way that they pose this question, kind of leads us to believe and understand that this was probably a pretty typical, like, remark that they would have in this day when they were kind of trying to put someone on the spot, like, haha, let's see someone answer this. Like, this is their, like, stump question, like the gotcha question. They would go in looking for an intellectual battle and be like, let's see the Pharisees, like, answer this. Or, you know, whoever they were arguing with, this is kind of their, like, it seems their particular thing that they just thought, like, we got them. This is it right here. And so they pose this particular story to Jesus. It's not a real story. It's not a real situation. It's a hypothetical that they're bringing forth. It technically could be real, but it's a hypothetical. And so here's what they ask in verse 28. They say, start off with the foundation, and they say, teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, having a wife but no children, the man must take a widow and raise up offspring for his brother. So the opening premise of this story is this thing called levirate marriage. Levirate just translates out to be like brother-in-law. So that's really what it means. But basically, they are referencing this law that is designed to continue a particular lineage of a man. So if a guy has a wife and he dies early and his name is not going to continue on, he's not going to continue to have heirs and a lineage, there was a law that prescribed that a brother would take care of this duty. In Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 5, you can read it, read a little bit more about it, but I'll give you just kind of this opening section here. In Deuteronomy 25, verse 25, if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside of the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. So in this particular thing, two things are happening. Number one, it's kind of like a dual protection here. Number one, this is the goal here is for this man's name and his family line to continue. And then secondly, this is to provide protection for this widow. Because if she was to go out on her own, then after being married for some time, the older you were in these cultures and in these communities, the less respect you would receive and command, the less opportunity that you would have. And most widows would go uncared for completely. That's why the New Testament and in the book of Acts, it tells us that one of the jobs of the church is to care for widows and orphans. It's because people didn't care about widows, right? They didn't want to take care of them. So it wasn't like she was going to go out and have like this great like opportunity to, you know, find a new family. It just probably wasn't going to happen. And you read similar stories in the book of Ruth, where you find that Ruth was in this situation where with Boaz, and she was in a situation where her husband died, and this became a situation in which this particular thing was practiced. Now, of course, the goal of our text this morning is to highlight this continuation of the lineage is what the Pharisees or the Sadducees are pulling out here. And so if this guy was to die and be childless, his brother was supposed to step up and raise a child for him, and then he would carry on the heritage. But the Sadducees, they're not just concerned with that one situation. Now they bring in just an absolutely absurd situation. Verse 29, they say, now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, right? So this is obviously the oldest. They're going down the line. The first took a wife and died without child. And the second and the third took her. And likewise, all seven left no children and died. So there's a chain of marriages that happen, right? So they're like, okay, we are good. We're good Jewish people. We follow the law. So the oldest guy dies. Obviously, this is a large family. So the next guy up, he marries this widow and tries to have a child in order to meet this this need, and that doesn't happen, and then he dies, and so it just goes on and so forth until they go through all seven, and nobody has a child. So it's kind of posed in this like absolutely wild, absurd situation here, and then it ends with this, you know, super considerate note from the Sadducees. Afterward, the woman also died. Like this is it. Like, they're just being like, and there was no success for anybody. They just go straight to it. She's dead. The story ends tragically. There are seven husbands, one wife, no kids. So basically, worst case scenario in this particular culture, in this situation. And then they pose this to Jesus in verse 33. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For the seven had her as a wife. So they don't care about the kids. You see what's happening here? They pose it as like they're going through the motions for the kids, but now they're going out and to say, well, whose wife is she going to be? Because she was married to all of them. Like, she was married to all these guys. So in the resurrection, who's she going to be married to? And their point is this. This dilemma that this woman is in is absolutely absurd. And so therefore, the resurrection couldn't possibly be true because she married all these guys one after the other after they died. And so if there was a resurrection, there's no way that she could be the wife to all of them. So the resurrection is not real. This is the way that they're thinking about this. They pose this in kind of this way, like, you know, you could almost hear them saying it. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will this woman be? Like, they're just kind of like, come on, Jesus. Like, you see that the resurrection is a joke. It's not real. Like, there's no adequate answer to this. There's not a way that you're going to give me anything that's going to satisfy us. Like, we got you, Jesus. How can she only have one husband in this afterlife? But their question, as Jesus will get to, presupposes the post-resurrection reality. They're like, we know what it's going to be like, and we know that this woman, if it is, it's going to come about in the same way that things are now. So here's what Jesus does. He comes back in verse 34, and he said to them, the sons of this age marry and are given in marriage. But those who are considered worthy to attain that age and to the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. So kind of confusing words there, because like, who talks like that? I guess Jesus does at this time. It's like, couldn't we have said that in a more simple way? Basically, what he's getting at is this. There's two different ages. There's the pre-resurrection reality, and there's the post-resurrection reality. There's before you die and after you die. And he says that there's a contrast between these two. It's not the same. The current age is not like the next. So he makes his point with two references here. First, he says, not everyone qualifies for life after the resurrection, right? This is how he leads off in verse 35. Those who are considered worthy to attain that age and to resurrection from the dead, right? So there's a way that you attain this. There is, not everyone qualifies. There's something that some are going to be counted worthy for that age. And some are going to be excluded from that post-resurrection reality. Now, he's not getting into what that means to be included or to be excluded from that. But we know from the previous passages that his desire is that everyone is included in this post-resurrection reality. And he's told us time and time again that his goal is to make it so that way everyone can be included. And it's not by our own efforts or by our own work, but through his work. In the Gospels, he tells us that he has come to give his life as a ransom for many. And what he's doing there is communicating that he is doing the work on our behalf. The efforts and the work that we have is insufficient. So if you kind of think about it like this, what he's putting forth is that there's a certain entrance into the post-resurrection reality. Okay? And what we talk about resurrection, what that means there is it's the reanimating of the person. You're being made new, made alive again. Not simply a revival from the dead, but a completely new creation. So Jesus is talking about something different, right? That's why there's two different ages. If it was the same age, you would be exactly the same. You would be exactly the same. You would just be revived after you die, and you would go about with everything being exactly the same. But he says that this is a new age, so things are completely different. Now, the entrance into the new age is brought about by the resurrection. Okay? Now, in John's gospel, what does he say? I am the resurrection and the life. Jesus himself, he makes that statement. I am the resurrection and the life. So if you want entrance into the post-resurrection reality, and Jesus says, I am the resurrection, then by logic, that means that the only way that you can have that entrance is by going to him. So that means then that when you go to him, the way that you find that entrance is not by doing good things or being a good person, but rather by recognizing your weakness and your need for him. That's what he's told us. He said, if you try to save your life, if you try to stack up your account so high and balance the scales and say, I've done a lot of good things, if you try to make that your main goal and your main focus, and you try to do that, when it ultimately comes time to stand before God, you're going to lose. Which is the opposite of kind of how we think about life a lot of times. Be a good person, don't be a bad person. Live in a good way, don't live in a bad way. Our good deeds ought to outweigh our bad deeds. And then that will be the thing that allows us to have entrance into the post-resurrection reality. But Jesus has told us that what is demanded for that entrance is not a bunch of good things, but rather perfection. Right? So unless you have a perfect record, it doesn't matter. Unless you have an immaculate, without blemish, without one mistake record, it doesn't matter. There's no way that it's going to balance out. And so this is why he has come to give his life as a ransom for many, because his record, his life is perfect and immaculate, without blemish. And when you come to him and you say, and make that confession, that like, I've been doing all these good things trying to get in, but I know it's not enough. And I know what those things, that they're not going to amount to what I need. And you make that confession before him. And you say, I want what you have, Jesus. I want that perfection. That's going to invite you into a relationship with him. So if he is the resurrection and the life, you've got to go to him. He's perfection. He is unblemished. He is the resurrection. And when you go to him, then of course you have entrance into the post-resurrection reality, because he is the resurrection. He is the one that opens these doors, that allows us to enter in. And so when he communicates this to these people, he is reminding them, not everyone's going to have entrance into this post-resurrection reality. Sadducees, it's not enough for you guys to just be like, we've been really keeping the rules there in those first five books of the Old Testament. We've been following that. That's not going to cut it, Jesus says. There's a new order that's in place. There are those who are considered worthy to attain that age. And then second, he goes about by speaking of this age by indicating that marriage and getting married are not a part of this future existence. Okay? So, life in the coming age is different than life in this age as far as marriage is concerned. The point that the Sadducees are making about, in their question about who's this lady going to be married to, it's irrelevant, Jesus says. The question is supposed to show the absurdity of the resurrection and how it doesn't, and how it like, it's like, it doesn't, the resurrection is not real. And Jesus says, the question itself is absurd and doesn't even apply because that era is not the same as this era. And so what Jesus is coming back and saying is that your understanding of the resurrection, Sadducees, is grounded too much in this time and this place. So he goes on to explain in verse 36 why there is no, why marriage is no longer needed. Now, before we jump into this, okay, here's a huge sidebar for you, okay? Because this is an important theological concept. Massive. In our day and age, in our church culture, and in probably kind of in popular culture, there's kind of this understanding, there's kind of this like idea that there is like a ranking system, like a hierarchy of like rankings. Okay, like, and it's basically, a lot of times we believe it to be this way, but this is not it, right? And I'm going to explain, okay? That there's like, okay, we are the church, and there's Christians, and we have like pastors and leaders, and they're at the top, and then there's like married people who are like at the next top, married people with kids, then there's just married people, and then there's like single people who are like crushing it, like you guys are the bottom level. But that's like not real. Okay? Jesus is talking about a post-resurrection reality, and he's communicating here that we don't need to have this particular institution in this situation. So that means that theologically, in the Church of God, that we're not ranking or aspiring to these particular roles because we are all equal and have all, all the same access to God and all the same value. So then, this is still part of the sidebar here, right? So, what then is the point of marriage, right? The point of marriage is for us to have an opportunity to grow in holiness with other people. That does not mean that you are unable to grow in holiness apart from, marriage, but rather that happens through a community that is formed around you, that is ministering to you and is inviting you in, right? So people within the church, if you're not married, there's not a less than category, right? Your worth and value and contribution is massive and huge. Faithfulness, huge. And so it's not something where there is a ranking system, right? So I want you to be encouraged there. I also don't want it to be a situation where you are thinking about it in these ways where having false idols or aspirations that are not, that you shouldn't be having and are not real. What you should be doing is seeking to be satisfied in Christ and in relationship with everyone that you have in the body of Christ. Now, a lot of times we think about marriage primarily through the lens of a romantic nature, and historically, that was not the main driver for that. Even when you look at the early marriages in the scriptures, the romantic part of that was not a part of it. It was mainly commitment-based and focused-based and a decision to covenant and love someone, right? And so it's not about finding romantic fulfillment, right? Which is most of the time what we think that marriage is about. Once you get married, you find out that that's really not what it's about, because it's easy to become unfulfilled in those arenas. But it's about that continuation of love and service. Mainly, it's about service. And so please don't misunderstand that in our current culture and in our modern day society, that like a lot of times that kind of gets falsely elevated. You just got to remember, like, that's not like real. That's not to say that it's not important, because God does say that he was the one who ordained marriage and created it. And of course, the main purpose of marriage there is it for it to be a picture of Christ in the church, right? Ephesians 5. So that's the main thing, to help us understand that relationship that we, the church, has with Jesus, right? So functional analogy there for us to see that, and other people are able to experience the blessings of that, as God has used that as an analogy as well. I could go on and on and on about this for a long time, but just want to have a little bit of a sidebar there, because it's important at what he's getting at. Because he does come back and he does say in verse 36, they cannot die anymore. This is the reason why there's no marriage, because they are equal to angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. So Jesus explains why marriage is no longer needed. Basically, his idea here is that there's no longer a need for children and families. Procreation, it's no longer, people don't die, so we don't need marriage. So what has Jesus boiled that down to? He doesn't say, well, you won't need marriage anymore because you know, we don't really care about that type of love. No, he's framing up marriage in this passage squarely as a commitment to procreation and the furthering of God's people, to that creation mandate. Remember all the way back in the book of Genesis, what does he tell them? He says, be fruitful and multiply. It's a part of the creation mandate to be fruitful and multiply. So in order to operate faithfully, he says, build a family, have kids. That's what he's told them to do. And so they're doing it. And he says, but then when we get to the resurrection, you don't need to be fruitful and multiply anymore. Like, no one's dying. No one's fallen off. Everyone's here. We're all here. I know exactly who's here. I know how many people are here. And life takes on a new order. So there's not the same need that exists. He says, they cannot die anymore because they are equal to angels and are sons of God. So those who attain the resurrection, he says, are just like the angels. Now, Judaism taught that angels don't need food or marriage, right? So these are the two things that you don't need if you're an angel, is what they're saying. And Jesus says, the people who do make it, they don't need marriage, and you probably don't need food in the same way. Now, another thing that's happening here is that by comparing, this is the masterstroke here, the resurrected people to angels, Jesus brings his attack out on the Sadducees at another doctrine that the Sadducees denied, the reality of angels. They didn't believe in that, so Jesus is like, okay, we're going to take on the resurrection head on, and we're going to take on angels here. And so this is how he frames it up as just an example for them. But then he gives his basis for this, right? And he's dealt with the Sadducees' question already, but there's still one issue that kind of needs to be addressed. First, the only way that he's dealt with the question is he just says, like, basically, like, that's a stupid question, because the age to come is not the same as this age. He didn't answer whether the resurrection is real. He just said, like, that's, like, your question is not, like, a really a great question. You're asking about something that is not relevant. It doesn't make any sense. But what he does do is pivot now to address the actual reality of the resurrection in verse 37. So here's how he goes about it in verse 37. But that the dead are raised, even Moses showed in the passage about the bush, where he calls the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So he wants to make sure that the Sadducees understand that the resurrection is scriptural, has scriptural basis. He could have appealed to a good number of Old Testament passages, right? The Pharisees probably would have gone back to something like Daniel 12:2, where we read, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So he says there's going to be a time where there will be a resurrection and some will awake to blessings and some will awake to curses. But he knows here that the Sadducees, they're not down with Daniel. They don't roll with him, right? They're just like, we only care about the first five books. And so he chooses a passage from the book of Exodus because the Sadducees hold these first five books in the highest authority. And so he begins to elaborate with this statement that the dead are raised, which he says Moses reveals. And he quotes Exodus chapter 3, verse 6. Okay, this is a power move beyond all power moves. He said, this is Exodus chapter 3, verse 6, and he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So he goes, number one, he goes back and he uses a passage from a book that they respected. And then not only that, he uses a direct quote from the mouth of God, right? I mean, come on. This is not some roundabout way. He's like, God himself has spoken these words. He has said these things. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, what is he doing there? As he references these things here, what God is doing with Moses in that situation is he's trying to tell Moses, like, hey, I'm about to send you into the promised land or to Egypt to rescue my people, and you're going to lead them into the promised land. I'm going to send you out there to deliver them, to rescue and save them, and I'm going to multiply you guys out there in this new land that I am giving to you. Now, why does he reference, the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob? Because what he's doing there is he's reminding Moses in that situation, hey, remember those guys? I made a promise to Abraham. I made a covenant to him. I made a promise to him that I will multiply him. His descendants will be more more than you can see the stars of the sky. I will make him a mighty nation, and out of him will become many blessings, right? And so that hasn't happened yet. And so there's a promise and a covenant that is still to be fulfilled. That has to happen. I'm the God of Isaac. I'm the God of Jacob. And so this is, when he says this, he's saying, I'm the God of promise and I'm the God of covenant. That I will see it through. I will do these things. And that statement brings with it implications. Look at verse 38. Now he is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him. So Jesus says that statement in Exodus chapter 3 implies resurrection. If God speaks of himself as the God of Abraham, then Abraham still exists. If he's the God of Isaac and Jacob, then they still exist. They're still alive, or they're going to be resurrected to experience these promises. Otherwise, God is lying. The patriarchs are not dead, and neither are God's promises to them. So he's going back and pulling this out for them to say, like, look, you guys would say that he is still the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? And this is still continuing now. So, like, connect the dots, guys. He's kind of pulling it out for them. And then he finishes with this: for all live to him. For all live to him. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. For all live to him. He finishes with that statement, which is just a beautiful thing that kind of summarizes much of what we've been talking about thus far. As he enters in the triumphal entry, they're making this declaration, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. As they're challenging his authority, he's coming back and saying, I'm the one that's really in charge. I'm the one that has true authority here. When he's telling the parable of the tenants who overthrow the vineyard and the beloved son is killed, he's continually making this confession and investment that the way that you overcome that judgment is to be alive to him. The way that he frames up the paying taxes to Caesar, saying if you're made in the image of God, you should render to God the things that are God's. It's the same thing. Live unto God. He says, he's not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him. All life exists in relationship to the living God. The sovereign God is responsible for all things. All life exists in him. Paul puts it this way. I'll give you three passages before we wrap up here. Romans chapter 11, verse 36. For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. So Paul referencing there that Jesus is the one who sustains us. Right? If he's the resurrection, right? What did we say? He's the resurrection and the what? Life. All live to him. If you want resurrection, you go to him. If you want life, you go to him. Colossians chapter 1, verse 16, also by Paul. For by him all things were created in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. All things were created through him and for him. Okay, remember, he's the creator. All life is to him. If he's the creator and he has made us in his image, right? He has designed us and formed us. Who gets to set the rules for that formation, for that purpose, for that life? The creator. And what did we say at the beginning? If you live within that form and that purpose, then there's flourishing. If you go outside of that, then you're likely to get injured. You're likely to get hurt. You're likely to experience things that you didn't that he didn't intend for you to experience. So living within that form, living within that purpose is acknowledging that he is the creator. You live unto him. Finally, Colossians chapter 3, verse 3. For you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory, right? So it finishes there. If you have died, right, you've died, and your life is hidden in Christ with God, right? We talked about that. He is the resurrection. So if you trust in Christ for salvation, and you know that he is what you need, and you go to him, and Paul tells us, if you've died and your life is hidden with him, you're with him, then when he appears, then you're going to appear because he has resurrected and therefore you will be resurrected. The post-resurrection reality comes about through him. And so all life takes place under his power, whether it's the current life or the life to come. He oversees it all. Then we kind of get this response here in verse 39. Then some of the scribes answered, "Teacher, you have spoken well." Okay, so what's happening here? This is great. Because what happens here is that the Pharisees, remember, they're like in charge and they're rolling deep and they've got the religious leaders all together. But the scribes, they slide in and they're like, this is not a sarcastic statement here from the scribes. Like, they're like full on honest here. Like, that was amazing. They're like, "Jesus, that was crazy good. Like, I can't even believe that." They're impressed. They like it. But remember here, what was happening before is that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they're enemies. They don't want to work together on this. But they're like, "We got to take down Jesus." So they're willing to work together to try to be like, "Okay, like, we took our blow. Now it's your turn to try to hit him. Now it's our turn to try to hit him." They're trying to taking turns. He's so good that the scribes are like, there's like a crack in their coalition of like opposing Jesus, where they're just like, that was really good. Like, they had to be like, see Sadducees, like, that what he said, that's the right way. Like, it's like they understood what was happening there. They kind of like the coalition to oppose Jesus starts to come apart just because his teaching is so good. Right here. They can't even hold it together. It's their attack. It doesn't work with this approach. And so we read in verse 40, for they, the they is the collective they, not here. They no longer dared to ask him any questions. So their dilemma is that they can't manipulate him. They can't get what they want. The doctrine of the resurrection is Jesus defends it. the issue that they have and is that they refuse to recognize God's power, that they live unto Him, which transforms the pre- and post-resurrection reality. If you live unto Him, of course, as the Creator, He would direct their lives. They simply did not want to live to Him. And so, they remain silent. They've got nothing else. Every possible group has attacked Jesus, taken a shot at Him. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, the leaders of the people, just everyone's coming at Jesus, and there's nothing else that they can say before Him publicly. At the end, you find that each encounter that they have with Jesus has left it clear that Jesus is really the only one with authority. He's the only one that has it all together. He's the only one that has the control. As much as they are looking to demonstrate their control, their mastery over the situation, they're realizing He's more in control than they understand. And so they don't even have any more questions that they can ask. They want to lose more of the grip that they already have. Every time they try to trick Him in front of the people, He ends up coming out looking better than before. And they lose their grip more and more on their power. Now, that's only a problem if you wish to remain in power. That's only a problem if you wish to remain in power. If they were giving Jesus more opportunity to speak and were opposing Him with genuine questions, and He was defeating these questions and bringing them confidence with His answers, and they were losing credibility and power before the people because there was a better and more faithful and more perfect answer, they could have just been like, this Jesus guy's right. We really should live unto Him. The only reason it's a problem is because they don't want to. They want to hold on to power. And of course, this is the same situation that we all struggle with. We all want the power. We all want the control. We all want to do what we want. But He's told us that in that giving up of power, in that release of that, in opening our hands and letting Him have control, in that release of our desire to control our time and our resources, our safety, our security, as soon as we let that go, in releasing it, we've become more secure and more safe than we've ever been. We've never been in a situation better than that. Because He is the one who cares for us. He is the one who's come to meet our needs. He is the one who has given up His life. And He welcomes us in to the resurrection when we trust in Him for salvation. He is the resurrection and the life. He is the one that we live to. Apart from Him, we can find none of these things. And so we can spend the rest of our lives trying to chase after those things that keep slipping away and we attain, but they fail to satisfy. And we can surrender and give up and be like, just do what you got to do. Jesus, do your thing. I'm not going to try to control it. I'm not going to try to manipulate you. I don't understand most of it, but you just do your thing. And I'm going to get out of the way. And when you do that, He instantly answers. He instantly comes to meet every need and care for you in a way that is deeper than we can ever know. That is the kind of love that God has for us. Let's pray. Lord, we are thankful for your kindness to us, for your care over our lives. We're thankful that you meet every need that we have. There's nothing that escapes your view. There's nothing that is hidden from you. You know us better than we know ourselves. And we know that you are constantly reminding us of your care. We recognize that you have given up your life for us, and we want to respond, and we want to say thank you and tell you that we want you to be in control. We want you to help. And we want you to have your way. And so this is just an opportunity for us to remember that again, that you care for us so deeply. And all we can do is say thank you. We can't pay you back in any other way but to say thank you and to give you our lives and to know you. And so meet us here as we respond. We love you. Amen.